Hey y'all,
you're listening to
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile.
My guest today is Gene Roseman, an author specializing in the Jewish history of Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. During research for one of her books, Miss Roseman stumbled across a totally forgotten tale of an axe murderer in the 1800s that predated Lizzie Borden even, and involved an extramarital affair, race, justice, and a cover-up. The upside is that Miss Roseman got a book out of the messy events, which she titled Barney and Clyde, and joined us back by the woodpile to give us the inside scoop.
So first of all, I want to ask you, how did you find out about the story that you're about to tell?
I was researching for a book on Jewish history that I wrote, Nashville Jewish History, and I came across a book at the Tennessee State Library and Archives called Fighting Against Fate. And I opened it, and it was filled with pictures, and it was a story written by a man about his mental illness. And he was Jewish, I knew from the beginning. And I started reading it, and after a while, I walked up to the librarian, and I said, is this book fiction? And she said, we are not a lending library. And so I said, but this is bizarre. And so the librarian started gathering around, and this book that had been on the shelf for almost a century was a great delight for everyone, and it involved a murder. And when I finished doing the book I was working on, I then researched it through papers, newspapers.
Okay, so the book that you found was about this murder you're going to tell us about.
Yes, it's about the murder and about the brother who, there are two brothers, and one is the murderer and the other is mad.
Okay.
A manic type. I actually put information in the second book I wrote, which is Shalom Nashville, and I put information in that book about the murder. In fact, I had a whole chapter on murders that affected the Jewish community in one way or another. I don't know how long you've been in Nashville, but there was a bizarre bombing of a house on Linwood Boulevard in the 80s, and I had that murder in there. Plus, I had murders that went back to to about 1900.
Do you read murder stories for pleasure? Or
I do not, but I found that the details were fascinating. Right. In some cases, the murders involved the Jewish person being the murderer. But in most cases, the Jewish people were victims, and mostly because they were in a workplace that was being robbed.
Now, can I ask one devil's advocate question? As a Jewish person yourself, is there a tendency to kind of shy away from when you said some of these murder stories, a lot of more a Jewish person was the victim, but sometimes they were the perpetrator. Did you ever get any grief from anybody? Like, hey, man, don't make us look bad.
Well, you know, this story that I currently have, Barney and Clyde, this has been somewhat difficult for me because there are descendants of the murderer here in town, the one who devised the plot for the murder. And it's interesting because my husband is very upset. He doesn't think I ought to be doing this. And the murder itself was suppressed so well that nobody in this time period ever knew about it at all.
Who suppressed it, do you think?
The Jewish community.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay, well, let's hear it. Tell me the story.
Okay. There are two brothers. Their names really are Meyer and Moses. They come from Europe with their mother and three other siblings, but those siblings caught typhoid fever in New York, and they died. So the mother marries another landsman, or a person from the village in Poland that she had come from, and he has two daughters, and they decide to come to Nashville as a married couple with two boys and two girls. And they set up a store here in Nashville, and they have a couple of more children themselves. And the older brother, Meyer, who will be known by Barney, because he assumes an American name. Mm-hmm. Barney falls in love with his stepsister, Rosa. Rosa is ravishing, and she's married off, as marriages were made to happen then. She's married off to a Russian peddler. He's gone a good deal of the time. Barney makes her pregnant. So then he decides he has to do something to clear the way for himself. So he talks the Russian peddler into getting an insurance policy for his wife should something happen to him. And then something does happen. Barney pays a black man $50 to take an axe to the peddler when he's home for Passover. Wow. And that happens, and the man dies. And he is so clumsy and naive. Everybody knows he's been having this affair with Rosa because everybody was living very closed in what was known as Black Bottom. Mm-hmm. Black Bottom was called Black Bottom, not because of black residents, which were there, of course, but because of the floods every year that left silt on all that area. Anyway, life is very close in Black Bottom. Everybody knows that Barney has been doing it, and he is arrested and tried. He's found guilty. He's sentenced as an accessory before the fact to life in prison. The black man who did the act is, he has escaped and gone to Louisiana, but he's found. He's brought back. He's tried. He's found guilty. Case closed? No. The case is appealed, and they find two legal points upon which the trial court had made an error. And so he's retried. That can't bring up those 2 points again, and he goes free. So here you have this situation where the white man, Jewish though he may be, is in prison for life for hiring him to do the murder, and the black man in 1886 goes free.
Wow.
And that is almost unthinkable.
Yes. Now, the black man, had he been in trouble before?
Or yes,
why was he chosen?
A whole series of problems. He was someone who worked on the riverboats and did odd jobs. And he actually worked for Barney. He did what was called drumming, where one would go out and drum up business by falling in step with a pedestrian walking on. Come on in and see what we have in here. Because Barney was a pawnbroker, used clothing store. And the black man, whose name was Thomas Owens, Owens would bring customers in and get a little profit on that. But yes, he was well known to Barney, and $50 was a lot of money
back
in 1884 when the murder was committed.
Now, the Barney, did he die in prison?
No. What happened is the Jewish community and the Gentile community was very distressed that the man who did the murder is walking the streets, and the man who conceived it and paid for it is in prison for life. So there's an appeal made to the governor, who was Robert Love Taylor of War of the Roses. I don't know if you know but the White Rose and the Red Rose, the two brothers ran against each other. This was his second term. And he pardoned Barney. So Barney spent 6 years in prison. Rosa, meanwhile, had disappeared. Nobody really knows what happened to her at all. She had Barney's baby and left the little girl plus another child here with her sister. And even in that family, descendants never knew that the sister who raised the two children had a sister named Rosa. It was so suppressed. It was such an embarrassment to the Jewish community.
Attention, please. Now, you said you were going to meet one of the descendants.
I did. Okay. I did. And
how did you find them, first of all?
Oh, he's here in Nashville. I knew who he was. And he bought a book And I didn't know how he would feel about it, but he called me up 2 days later and he said, "This is wonderful."
Really?
And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, now I know the story, because it mainly is based totally on fact. I had to build a few fiction bridges in there. Mm-hmm. For instance, I accounted for Rosa as going off to New York and marrying somebody else."
So your book is more a work of fiction just based on...
It's much more work of fact. It's like 95% absolute fact.
What points did you choose to make fiction and why?
Things that I couldn't account for, like what did happen to Rosa. That was the major thing. And of course, putting words into people's mouths, you don't know for sure that they said them or said them like that. So those are things that I felt a little unsure about. I've basically been a researcher, and everything is cited and properly documented. So this was my first foray into fiction at all.
Okay.
But it's historical fiction, and it's totally based on fact.
Now, Barney, after he was out of prison, what did he go on to do?
Well, interesting question. He went back into the family business. He met a woman who had just immigrated from Hungary, and he married her, and he had two children. He had three. One died. But he had two boys 10 years apart. And the second boy is the father of the descendant, who is now 90 years old.
In a lot of communities, especially tight-knit communities, ethnic communities, if something like that happens, they tend to shun that person because he's an embarrassment. Now, did he get that treatment from the Jewish community?
Very good question. The name of the family was actually Moskowitz. And what happened, another family, not related, also named Moskowitz, changed their name to Morse, M-O-R-S-E, and that was the family that owned the Merchant's Hotel. And there were other people who absolutely wanted no involvement with the family. I did a memoir for a man recently whose last name is Moskowitz, and his father was asked, "Why don't you change your name?" And he said, "Well, I've got a clear conscience. I didn't kill anybody." But yes, there was a lot of concern about that.
Were you able to find out what was the reaction of maybe the rabbis at the synagogue? I mean, because obviously they're very involved in the community.
Not really. What I did find is that Barney's stepfather was considered an unclean Hebrew. I followed a case that was actually in the circuit court about his having the ability to read prayers during the high holidays. Some in the synagogue didn't want him to because he was supposedly unclean. But then the case was dismissed, so I never found out whether he did it or not.
And the black man, do you know how he ended up in life?
Yes, that's a very good question. He took a bullet through the head.
So he must have made somebody else angry, huh?
He made somebody else angry.
Now, the man who was murdered, his family, were you able to contact them at all?
No, because he had come to America as an immigrant alone. And his father had been a childhood friend of Barney's stepfather. They all came from the same village. So he had no family here. And even in the newspapers of the time, they looked upon him as being somewhat no count. You know, he was here. He didn't speak English well. He was a peddler. He didn't earn much money. And he was buried and, I think, forgotten about.
No one to mourn him, I guess, huh?
No one to mourn him because Rosa was too busy, pregnant with Barney's child, and thinking about getting out of town. There's a very interesting look into life in Black Bottom. And
now, Black Bottom, who lived there? The black folks?
Very good question again. Black folks, but they came after the war. The first to come really were the Irish, and then the Jewish storekeepers came, dry goods, confectionery stores, and so forth. So you had mostly black, Irish, and Jews in that area, and they lived together so surprisingly well. It really amazed me that there was such intercourse among all these groups.
And when you say intercourse, they got along as neighbors? I mean,
they got along as neighbors.
Was there intermarrying going on that you know of?
That's a good question. I don't know that for sure. I would tend to think not, certainly not in the Jewish world, but possibly in the Irish area, and but probably not with blacks. I do know there were lots of prostitutes that plied their trade there. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of other people that came in.
Yeah, so there might have been intercourse of a kind.
Of all kinds, right?
But you were about to say about Black Bottom. I'm sorry.
Black Bottom was essentially the first four streets from the river through Cherry, which mm-hmm. is now Fourth Avenue. And it was an area that the finer people didn't live in because it flooded.
Well, sure, yeah. And now you had told me earlier that some of these buildings are still here today.
The building in which the Moskowitz family and store lived is still there. It is directly behind Merchant's Hotel, and it is now the Swinging Door Saloon.
Uh-huh. So you went into the saloon to
No, I haven't. I took a picture on a Sunday morning when there was not much traffic, so that I have a very good picture of it. But I haven't been in it yet.
I was sad and I was blue, but now I'm just as good as you, since Henry Ford apologized for me.
You said you came across some other murder stories where maybe a Jewish person might have been a victim or something. What are some of the better stories, the ones that you found more interesting in your research?
Well, this is not a victim. This was a doctor, Hermann Feist, and he was just handsome, and of course he was a doctor, and all the Jewish mothers were hoping that their daughters would become his wife,
right.
But he was a gambler. You know, there was a great deal of gambling in Nashville and drinking, but he was most of all a gambler, and he found one woman, Sarah Goldstein, who gave him gifts of her money. She was a working woman herself in 1903, and I suspect she might have been pregnant because she broke into his office and got into his morphine closet and took some and killed herself. All right. Everybody's upset about that, but the good doctor goes on gambling and dating and so forth. And then he finds a Gentile woman who is married to a barber, but she herself has quite a bit of money and jewelry and so forth. And they have assignations around town. And he convinces her to run off to Chicago, where she's from, with him, and he'll set up a practice there. He'll meet her at Union Station. This is 1906. He supposedly was going to meet her there, and she would take the train, and he would be in another car. And she shows up, and nobody sees her ever again. They find her 3 months later floating in the Ohio River. And people around town knew that he had been involved with her, knew he was a ladies' man. Suspicion is turned on him. He's tried. And he is found guilty. The case is appealed, and he goes free because the body had been found in Ohio, and Davidson County was not the venue of the murder. So the Supreme Court ruled that it couldn't apply there. And the man went back to Alabama from whence he came. And he practiced medicine illegally because they took his license, but he practiced it anyway, and they needed him. That was a murder that pops up now and then of interest. And as I said before, several were in the workplace, and they were just unfortunate situations.
When you say in the workplace, was it caused just by someone getting angry at each other, or or
no, robbery.
Oh, robbery.
And one might have been getting angry. They never solved it. It's a cold case. It was a lawyer who handled a lot of divorces, and he was found dead in his office by the secretary the next morning, and they never did find who he was. There were a couple of killings on Charlotte, one across from Cone High School. Woman at 12 o'clock noon had just had a hysterectomy, and she was manning the store while her husband ran an errand, and somebody came in and demanded the money, and she had a gun under the counter, and he stabbed her, and she died. Yeah. And then there was another one further down on Charlotte. So those are the kind of things I think that were more inclined to happen. Right. Another was an insurance salesperson who had to collect the insurance premiums once a month, and he had been out collecting for his colleague. It wasn't even his route, and three youngsters stabbed him to death. So those are the kinds of things that I think have happened more as a result of just having, you know, money.
Seeing you going up Cedar Street Hill, I know you got your whiskey from Jack Daniel's still. Jasper really jumps all night long. I'd rather be in Nashville than to be way back that home.
You've done lots of research about Jews in Nashville and that history there. As far as you can tell, who were the first Jewish immigrants to come to the Nashville area and why?
Well, interestingly, Nashville was founded in 1780. The first Jews of record came in 1795. And even more surprising is it was a couple. And the man was a native-born American at that point. And he had lost his first wife, and he was searching for something else than being in New York. And he and his second wife, who was pregnant, made their way here during the winter of 1795. She had a baby here, and they moved on. But they moved to Virginia. I guess they felt it was, you know, too cold and too wild, because at that time, Nashville was considered one of the westernmost points of America. It was rough. I mean, it was a fortress, Fort Negley, various settlers lived in. Anyway, then through the early 1800s, a number of people traveling elsewhere came through. They were rabbis, tutors, doctors, tailors, but they tended to move on. By about 1840, a number of immigrants were actually coming to Nashville and not only setting up shops, because they had backing from Cincinnati, which was known as the Queen City. They were not only setting up shops, but they were encouraging peddlers to take their wares out. So there were quite a number that came. And the first Minyan, where they had a number of 10 men in order to have the service, was held in 1849 in a house. And then, not rapidly, but consistently, steps were taken to found a congregation. And then a second congregation of people who were more Orthodox developed. And then a third congregation developed of people who were even more Orthodox.
Okay.
And you, for another 50 years, that's all you had, was the Reformed Temple, known as the Vine Street Temple, and you had the Gay Street Synagogue, which was conservative, and then you had the Orthodox, which was the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, and it was right next door to the Ryman Auditorium.
Okay.
And people would wander in on a Saturday in the morning and think that this was strange country music.
You know? Oh, I bet, yeah.
Before they realized they weren't in the Ryman. But anyway, then about mid-century after the war, there was this feeling out with the old, in with the new, and urban development started downtown, and the Gay Street Synagogue was the first to go down because they leveled that whole area. And it's behind the Capitol Mm-hmm. And then the Fifth Avenue Synagogue was sold for a parking lot, and they moved out to West End, and the Gay Street Synagogue came to West End. And then lastly, the Reformed Synagogue moved to the Belmead area. Mm-hmm. So it changed the configuration of Jewish life, because the Jews followed and came out on West End, and now more toward Bellevue, and there's been two synagogues in Bellevue.
Now, I know in New York City, in the Jewish community, most people don't realize that there's divisions in every community, you know, and there's one group looking down on another. And I think I remember where there was, like, the German Jews might have looked down on the Polish Jews or the Russian Jews. And there was even great links to keep them out of certain industries. You know, they treated them maybe just as bad as other Gentiles. In Nashville, was there that dichotomy?
Absolutely, there was. The first Jews who came here were essentially German Jews. They were European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews. And they were very influenced by the reform movements in Germany and the Gentile churches. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they had organs in their synagogue, pianos, and they encouraged the use of the vernacular in the prayer books and so forth. And they felt themselves above the immigrant Jews who came from Russian Poland and you know, basically from that area, Hungary,
right.
Eastern, and there was a great tide of those kind of immigrants that came in after 1880, and in most cases they did well but they were shoemakers and tailors and did more base work, and the Germans were the shopkeepers, and they had their very fine club, similar to the Belmead Club, mm-hmm. called the Standard, and still that exists, because you have the descendants of the German Jews mm-hmm. at the Vine Street, or at the temple mm-hmm. here, and you have more of the descendants of the Russian Jews at West End and the Orthodox Synagogue.
In some communities, even though they're divided, they will come together on a few things. Did you find that also to be the case?
Well, let me kind of talk around that to give you an idea of where I want to go with
this.
Yeah,
sure.
My husband can walk into a room and not know anybody. He can pick out anybody who's Jewish. Mm-hmm. And there is this tie that binds mm-hmm. with Jews. Mm-hmm. And Jewish charities mm-hmm. are very supportive of their own. And in fact, I am currently researching the Industrial Removal Office. We just spoke about immigrants. And when they came to America, they more or less settled in the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. and it became terribly overpopulated, and there was no employment. So the German Jews in New York came up with the idea of the Industrial Removal Office, mm-hmm. a poor name, but nonetheless, they would remove the whatever numbers they could to communities that already had a settled Jewish population and expect them to find jobs for mm-hmm. them and take care of them. And there were 185 that came here to Nashville. Most did not stay. Some of them went to other communities. Some just didn't like it because it was too hot and there were no union wages mm-hmm. and so forth. But that Industrial Removal Office functioned mm-hmm. for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And then when they cut off immigration into this country mm-hmm. in the 1920s, it stopped completely.
In spite of the odds against him, Jewish refugees fleeing the horrors of Nazi Germany and communist Soviet Union and Eastern Europe have struggled but thrived in Nashville. Ms. Roseman shared a little of what she's learned of these first-generation Americans.
I was very privileged to know them over the years,
okay.
and I have a great deal in my book about their personal stories. They're okay. Just incredible what they endured. Unfortunately, now we only have the children who survived the Holocaust. And as far as the Russian Jews are concerned, they've made a huge impact on the community here, but they had to be helped because they came without language. And they, in many cases, they came with skills. They were engineers and lawyers and so forth, but they couldn't pass the exams here.
Right.
One case in particular was Elizabeth, who opened a bridal store in Hillsborough Village, and she was an engineer, and she could take a dress and make it work on any woman. Matter of fact, she began to cater to the country music stars and did very, very well. She sent her children to really fine schools. They married well, and they're very blended into the community now.
I read about a man one day who wasted not his time away,
but he prayed to God.
He prayed to God every morning, noon and night.
He cared not for the things of heaven.
In regards of culture, Southern culture and Jewish culture, did you find evidence of it mixing into little hybrids of sorts, whether it be food or art or understandings of the like philosophy of life? Did you ever find that in your research?
One thing I did find in my research was what one Jewish merchant called the 5 o'clock curtain. Things were fine during the day when the business front, but at 5 o'clock, the socializing stopped. Jews were not ever permitted to join the Belmead Country Club, for instance, until recently. There is one token member and one token black. But, essentially Jews were
had to stay to themselves
because they weren't invited. They were never invited to other people's homes for dinner. They were considered different. But respected and very supportive of the community all the way around and very proud to be Americans. There were like 150 Jewish men who went into World War I and a whole lot of men and women who went into World War II. There were 6 women and I believe it was something like 350 men.
That may be my question probably is from taken from a modern sensibility because these days everybody intermingles. But I know that wasn't the case for really the history of the world. People stayed to themselves, they stayed with their own kind, and it wasn't necessarily racism, it was just the way they survival, you know. So I understand that.
You're right. Yeah.
Sweet, sweet baby. My world's so cold and empty since you've gone.
Now you speak about these subjects. What are the reaction? Is there a lot of interest?
Mostly I talk to Jewish groups, although also next week I'm going to be speaking at Nashville Archives about Dinah Shore. She's beloved among people who are older.
Yeah, I remember her.
You're under 50. There's no way you would know her.
I think my grandparents might have liked her, and I think they might have watched her in reruns or something.
Everybody loved her back then. She was just the most warm, effusive person, and she grew up here in Nashville.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, she grew up on Whitland. The house is still standing there.
I didn't even know she was Jewish until Adam Sandler did a song, I think it's called the Hanukkah song, and he goes through and lists all the famous Jews you don't know were Jews.
David Lee Roth lights the menorah, so do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore.
You know, that's part of it because there are people here, she had family here, there are people here who feel that she didn't stay true Jewish, but that's not so. Because there's another woman who has moved here to Nashville, and she actually had Dinah Shore's children in a Jewish overnight camp. She was a counselor. And I know that she gave quite a bit of money to her temple. I know she also was very supportive of Vanderbilt. Not that that was Jewish, but she did not cut her hometown ties at all.
Where's that gal with a red dress on? Some folk call her Dinah. stole my heart away from me way down Louisiana. Take me back to Tulsa.
The unfortunate effects of thrilling scandals and juicy stories is they tend to overshadow the dull everyday harmony and general positive. I asked Miss Roseman what were some of the unknown contributions of the Jewish community in the Middle Tennessee region.
I would say charitably. You know, they're very, very supportive. For instance, during World War I, Lee Loventhal raised $2.4 million. And Jews have always been supportive of the arts in particular. Even if you drive through downtown and you see the library, and you, if you go inside and look, you will see many Jewish names with large amounts of money given. Same if you go to TPAC and you see who's supporting the TPAC. Also, in front of the library, there are 26 books piled high, each one representing a letter of the alphabet, and Noah Lift gave that. And Noah Lift also supported the opera here in town. So Jews have, in many cases, anonymously been
As I say, they're very quiet about it.
Right. Yeah. Jewish people tend not to feel that their name should be on anything at all. They tend to do things anonymously.
Well, Gentiles, if they're Christians, are supposed to do the same thing. They're supposed to do the good works in quiet.
That's exactly.
But unfortunately, a lot of times people use it to...
Well,
to,
some for Jewish further, people do put their names on things, too.
To further their careers, I guess,
Yeah, that's what I like about the South.
Now, if people want to buy the book or get a hold of you, how do they go about doing that?
I have a website, barneyandclyde.net, and if they go and hit on the order page, then it will take them to an email address where I will then send them a copy of the book.
Okay.
The book is $25.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on here.
Well, thank you for having me.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.
That's what I like about the South.
Bye-bye.
Down where the trees grow tall, where everybody says y'all. Walk on in with that southern drawl, and that's what I like about the South.